Academic Test 1. You'll hear a number of different recordings, and you'll have to answer questions on what you hear. There will be time for you to read the instructions and questions, and you will have a chance to check your work. All the recordings will be played once only. The test is in 4 parts. At the end of the test, you'll be given 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the answer sheet. Now turn to Part 1. Part 1. You'll hear a telephone conversation between a receptionist at a restaurant and a man who is making inquiries about a job there. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Now listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5.
Hello, Marina Restaurant and Reception Rooms. How can I help you?
I'm ringing about the advertisement I saw on the internet. You were advertising for casual staff?
Yes, that's right. Just a moment, I'll put you through to the manager. I'm sorry, there's no answer on her line. Perhaps I can help you with some of the details and you could talk to her later.
Yeah, that'd be good. First of all, can you tell me what jobs are available?
Well, we advertised for an assistant cook, a kitchen hand and a cleaner, but the cook and the cleaner's positions have been filled already.
Not to worry. I'm not qualified to cook anyway. I can barely make toast.
Well, we still have the kitchen hand job available. Do you have any experience?
Nah, I haven't worked as a kitchen hand before. What would I have to do?
Mainly dishes, lots of dishwashing, and anything the chef tells you to do while he's preparing the meals. We get pretty busy, so you'd have to be able to deal with some pressure, and there's a fair bit of noise and shouting sometimes too. You'd be responsible for making salads and other cold platters.
I could do that. How many shifts would I have to work every week?
A minimum of 2 and a maximum of 5. We're open 7 days a week, and our casual staff are usually asked to do a lot of weekend shifts. You probably won't have to do many Mondays or Tuesdays, but you'll have to be able to work on Friday nights. That's our biggest day of the week.
There goes my social life.
Sorry?
Nothing. I was wondering what the pay's like.
It's very good, really. The youth rate is $15 an hour. Oh, I didn't ask. How old are you?
22.
Well, that's an even better rate. Over 18, we pay $18.50 an hour, and that includes a meal if you work a 5-hour shift.
I like the sound of that. What time is the meal break?
It's very early, before you actually start work, at 5 o'clock. Oh, and I should tell you, if you are even 5 minutes late, you won't get any dinner at all. The chef is very strict about that. You need to start your meal at 5, because you have to begin work promptly at 5:30 p.m.
I'll be sure to get there before 5 then. I'm always starving in the afternoon, and I don't mind how early I eat dinner.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen and answer questions 6 to 10.
I have a question. Would I need to wear a uniform of some sort?
Not as such, but you'll need a good strong pair of shoes, not sneakers. That's in case you drop something on your foot. A clean shirt and trousers. And the restaurant provides you with a long white apron and a cap.
When can I start?
Not so fast. You'll have to formally apply to the manager first. But I can tell you that the position becomes available on Monday, the 14th of November. That's when we really start to get busy, in the lead-up to Christmas and the holiday season.
When can I see the manager?
Let me see. I have her diary here. What about tomorrow at 11 a.m?
Not really. Not unless I skip class. Is there something later in the day?
4:30 p.m? Would that do?
Yeah, great. So that's 4:30 tomorrow. Thursday with, what's her name?
Oh, the manager, yes. Her name is Lola Barry.
Just a minute while I write that down. B-A-R-R-Y?
There's no Y. It's B-A-R-R-I-E.
Lola Barry. I've got it now.
Good. You've got her name, but I haven't got yours.
Jack Lee. That's L-E-E.
Thanks, Jack. When you come to meet with Ms. Barry tomorrow, bear in mind that she'll want to know all about your work history, so you'll need to have your CV. If you have one, we'd really like to see a reference as well, so bring that with you, if you can. If you haven't got one, then we'll need a referee's name and a phone number instead. Oh, and one more thing.
What's that?
She'll probably ask you about your eligibility to work in this country, so bring your passport and, if you have one, your tax number.
Thank you. You've been really helpful. Will I see you tomorrow?
Yes. Come straight through the front door and you'll see me at reception. Ms. Barry will meet you there.
Great. Till tomorrow then.
That is the end of part one. You now have half a minute to check your answers to part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. You'll hear a teacher talking to a group of students who are visiting the city zoo. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 16. Now listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 16.
How many of you have visited the city zoo before? No one? Well, this is going to be a treat. Before we get off the bus, let me give you a bit of background information. When this city was founded in 1860, it was the intention right from the start to set aside some land for what would become today's zoo. Unfortunately, the plans were lost somewhere in the town planning department, and the whole idea was almost forgotten until one of the town's founding fathers died just after the turn of last century, 1902 it was, and he bequeathed to the city a stretch of unused land. He had given the land to the council with the express wish that it be used to build a zoo, but it would be another half century before construction began in 1950. The gentleman who gifted the land simply wanted a place that his grandchildren and future generations would take pleasure in, and so that was the idea behind the design and construction of the zoo. Later, researchers set up a science lab here and started a project to save animal species that are in danger of extinction. Okay, everyone off the bus. Please follow me. I'll go through the entrance first because I have all the tickets. Right, is everyone with me? Good. Now, when families come here at the weekend, they normally head straight for the monkey enclosure here on our right. But we're going to head north past the nursery. Yes, this is where all the zoo babies are born, to the education block. Please take note of where we are, because we'll come back to the center after we've had a look at the animals. And there'll be a member of the zoo staff to answer your questions and show us a DVD. Now, if we turn and walk east, you'll see a lake on your right and the polar bears on your left. As you know, they like colder temperatures, and the waters of the Blue Lake are kept chilly just for them. See? They can get to the lake by going under this bridge we're standing on. If we go straight on, we'll come to another lake. But that is for the reptiles and amphibians to lounge around in. Let's head north again. Are you all with me? All right, we'll stop here for a quick look at the children's petting zoo on our right. Yes, this is one enclosure where the people and the animals can mix. There are lots of small farm animals here, and they are all very tame, because the idea is that city children can get up really close and touch them if they want. You might like to come back here when we've finished our tour. Okay, let's step out of the petting zoo now, and next up is the aviary, right in front of us. It's divided into a roofed-in section in the northern part, and the bigger birds are kept in the southern half. Let's follow the path to the west now. Please try to keep up. I don't want to lose any of you. On our right is the African savanna, which, as you can see, is very large, so the big cats have plenty of room to roam. You can spend more time here later. Keeping west now, we walk alongside the savanna towards the Asian rainforest. Sometimes you have to stay very still if you want to see the animals that live here. All right, I'm going to leave you now. You can either retrace your steps or continue around the zoo until you get back to where we're scheduled to watch the DVD in exactly 1 hour's time. See you then.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 17 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 17 to 20.
It's good to see that you all made it here on time. How many of you went back to the petting zoo? All of you? I'm not surprised. It would have been my choice as well. The miniature pigs are my absolute favorite. You know, they used to have a larger variety of animals in there, but they decided to remove the domestic pets, like cats and dogs, because most kids have access to those in their neighborhoods, if not at home. The goats and sheep are always popular, and the rabbits used to be too, but they were found to have some kind of disease and had to be taken away. There were farm birds once as well, hens, but they didn't like being cuddled, and they used to peck the children who picked them up, so they were returned to the farm where they came from. So, time now for the DVD. We've arranged for you to watch it because, as you know, the breeding and nursery facility is off-limits to the public, for very good reasons. But we all want to see the zoo babies, don't we? This DVD, as well as books on exotic and endangered animals, and leaflets about the history of the zoo, are all available in the bookshop, which we'll stop and have a look at on our way out.
That is the end of part two. You now have half a minute to check your answers to part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. You will hear a conversation between a student called June and her academic counselor. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Thanks for coming to see me, June. I understand that you've been referred to academic counseling because of a rather poor outcome on your mid-year exams, is that right?
Yes. I manage quite well with the course assessments, but I just seem to go to pieces at exam time, and passing the exam is an essential criterion.
Yours is quite a familiar situation. Exams often trigger stress and anxiety amongst students, but believe me, they're not intentionally designed to do so.
I don't know why we have to have exams in the first place.
Well, I guess the main reason is to test students under control conditions so they can demonstrate what they're capable of themselves as individuals without any outside assistance.
But I find them such a strain, and it's not because I don't study.
Well, let me run through some exam preparation tips with you. We'll see if you can learn how to maximize the effectiveness of your preparation and reduce exam anxiety to get a better outcome.
All right.
You're given a course outline that tells you when you'll be sitting the exam and how much it will contribute to your overall grade.
Yes, but they give that out in the first week of the course.
Precisely. Once you have it, you begin to set your exam goals. And from the very first day of lectures, you make sure you take good notes because these are essential for good exam preparation.
Oh, I've got heaps of notes.
But did you make summaries?
Well, no. Anyway, some lecturers use PowerPoint presentations and they give you a handout with the slides on.
Yes, but slides alone are not sufficient. You still need to write down explanations and examples and add your own notes to the slides.
Oh, I see.
As you progress through the semester, it's important to keep up to date with your summaries, not just of the lecture notes, but chapters of any books you've read or articles in journals. Be selective, though. There's just so much information on the internet, and it's very difficult to discern what's valuable and what is not. And it's probably not worth the effort to summarize what you read there.
Still, that seems like a lot of summarizing.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Yes, June, but that's the key to exam preparation. At revision time, you make a summary of all your summaries. And be sure to start revision before the end of lectures because lecturers often hold a couple of revision seminars before the end of the course.
Do I need to go to those? I thought they were optional.
They are, but you should attend. It's often in those seminars that you get really useful information to help you with the exams. And before you go, you must have gone through all the course material. Read critically and carefully. And have questions prepared if there is anything you don't understand.
Yes, that sounds like a good idea. So the secret is to start revision really early. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but you can also set goals for your exams. And in your case, this is pretty straightforward because no matter how well you've done on continuous assessment tasks, you still need to get 50% in each exam, right?
Yes. Passing the exam is compulsory in each of my courses.
Then I suggest you target your weaker subjects and focus more effort on them in the lead-up to exams. Get a copy of your exam schedule as soon as it's available and make yourself a timetable. Fill in every day from the beginning of study week to the last exam. Write down all the tasks you have to do.
You mean like sorting lecture notes, revision, and practicing past papers?
Yes, although any sorting should be done straight after the last day of lectures. And don't forget to build in some relaxation time. I'm glad you practice past papers. That's a really good strategy. You know that different examiners like different styles of exams.
Really?
Yes, of course. Multiple choice, essay, short answer, open book problem solving. All those formats require different strategies. And you need to be aware of the format that your examiners prefer. What have you noticed so far?
Well, multiple choice is popular.
Ah, yes, good old multiple choice. Do you like that style?
I'm not sure, really. I sometimes get a bit confused with those ones, and there are always so many questions.
Yes, examiners like those because they're easy to mark, but of course they're harder to write. But from your point of view, you need to remember that multiple choice exams usually rely on recognition rather than recall.
What does that mean?
Well, you only have to know your subject matter well enough so that you can recognize the right answer when you see it.
So that means it's easier?
Not exactly. You can get a lot more questions, which means that you need to cover the breadth of the subject, but you don't need to study it in great depth.
Thanks. You've been really helpful.
That is the end of part three. You now have half a minute to check your answers to part three. Now turn to part four. Part four. You'll hear a lecturer giving a talk on feral camels in Australia. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Today we're going to be looking at the ecological impact of the feral camel in Australia. As you know, a feral animal is one that survives in the wild even though it originally lived with people in a domestic situation. Camels are not native to Australia, so how did they get here? Or, more importantly, why? The importation of camels began in 1840 and continued through to 1907. They were brought here to aid in opening up the arid and semi-arid regions of inland Australia. Initially, they provided transport for people and goods involved in exploration or mining in the outback. They were also used to carry equipment for the construction of railways and telegraph lines. And often, they were the only way many remote settlements could receive supplies. Where did they come from? Well, curiously enough, from as far afield as China and Mongolia. That was the large, woolly, two-humped Bactrian camel. And of course, there were dromedaries, the typical Arabian camels used primarily for riding. But most of them were from lowland India. These ones, in particular, were very large and powerful, and they were used to carry or move heavy freight. What we have now are feral camels that are mixtures of these different breeds. Why are they feral? Well, once the railways were up and running and motor vehicles were becoming more common in the outback, they weren't needed anymore. So many of the 20,000 or so domesticated camels that were around in 1930 were just let go. And because they were so well adapted to desert conditions, they thrived and bred and spread right across central Australia. What's the problem, you might ask? After all, they're just camels living in the desert. The problem is that they are an introduced animal, a very large one at that, and they do extensive damage to the desert ecosystem. They wander up to 70 kilometres in one day, grazing on whatever vegetation is available. That might be grass, shrubs, or trees up to 3.5 metres high. In times of drought, when water is scarce, they are capable of drinking up to 200 litres each in 3 minutes. Although, if they're consuming a lot of green, moist plant material, they don't need that much. They gather around precious waterholes to get this water, and the degradation of these waterholes is of serious concern. They are crucial for the survival of a wide variety of native animals and plants. Many of these are now threatened to the point of extinction. Let me also point out that these watering places have a long-standing cultural significance, and many of them are sacred sites for the Aboriginal people. Feral camels are literally trampling all over and violating Aboriginal traditions and history. In periods of extreme drought, like Australia has experienced in recent years, there is no limit to their quest for water. Camels are big animals and they go pretty much wherever they please. They are not primarily interested in hurting people, but it's not advisable to get in their way. They have gone into remote communities and damaged domestic infrastructure, such as washing facilities in laundries and bathrooms, as well as outside bores, taps and tanks. Let's see. Feral camels have a negative impact on native vegetation and animals, water supplies and Aboriginal and outback communities, but they are no friends of the farmers either. They compete with livestock for pasture and they can wreck the farmer's precious property in the process, knocking down fences, windmills and water troughs. Camels also carry some of the same diseases as livestock and are likely to spread infection among cattle and other farm animals. On top of all that, they cause a number of collisions with trains, cars and trucks. Oh, and one more thing, camels are ruminants, which means they emit methane, and they are having a significant impact on climate change. Feral camels do have some value as a resource. There is a small export market in camel meat, and the pet meat trade uses them as well. Although camels have a reputation for being stubborn and even vicious, they are easy to domesticate once they are captured. We don't use them in industry anymore, but sometimes they are used by tourist operators as a novelty form of transport for their customers. Even so, it would seem their usefulness is limited and far outweighed by their overall harmful economic, environmental, social, and cultural impact.
That is the end of part four. You now have half a minute to check your answers to part four.
That is the end of the listening test.